I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, as San Antonio Mayor Gina Ortiz-Jones and other officials are calling for the canceling of Kanye West's July 4th concert at the Alamo Dome, how are local concertgoers reacting? We're going to have the latest. Also, why are gas prices so all over the place? They can swing 50 cents a gallon from gas station to gas station and jump and dip from day to day. What can we expect to see with the price at the pump and with the threat of a looming oil shock? And later on The Source, the Texas Rangers are frequently called in to crack a murder case in small towns in Texas, but do they always do a good job? The Texas Observer investigates the investigators for a murder in the Rio Grande Valley and finds the Rangers lacking. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be hearing about what is happening with gas prices. Why are they varying so much right now and what could be around the corner? But first, San Antonio Mayor Gina Ortiz-Jones and other local officials have called for the canceling of a Kanye West concert planned for the Alamo Dome on July 4th. West has a history of making anti-Semitic remarks. Sanford Nowlin is the editor of the San Antonio Current, and he's been covering the story, and he joins us now. Sanford, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
This story, I'm wondering what you're hearing, because the San Antonio Current, you really do provide a lot of information to concert goers in San Antonio. What is the take there?
Well, I think there are some folks in town who don't want to see him play here based on the past remarks he's made. But I've also seen a lot of traffic on our site or on social media. People who are excited about the concert. I mean, regardless of how you feel about him based on opinions he shared and later apologized for and attributed to mental health issues, I mean, he is somebody who released a couple of groundbreaking hip-hop albums that really put him on the map as a significant performer. And I think there are quite a few people, quite a few fans that are willing to overlook some of the things he said. And as of Monday, there were about 50,000 tickets sold to that event. It's expected to draw about 60,000 in total. And from what I'm hearing for the city, only about 14,000 of those are from Bexar County. So that means there are about 23,000 that have been sold in other Texas counties and about 15,000 sold outside of Texas and another 200 international sales. So it's not just what San Antonio fans think. It's what fans regionally, I think, feel about wanting to see Ye play the show.
So the pressing question is, will the city council, it would take the council to vote in order to stop this concert. And today, six members of the city council signed a letter saying that they condemn Ye's remarks, his anti-Semitic history, and they would not, quote, censor him and allow it to go forward. Suk Kaur, we have McKay Rodriguez, Terry Castillo, Mariana Aldorete Gavito, Misty Spears, and Mark White have signed that letter. That's the majority of council. So the council will not have a majority to stop this concert.
Yeah, I mean, the way this works in San Antonio governance is the city-owned concert facilities are overseen at the highest level by the city manager. And to override that, to order the city manager to cancel the concert would take a majority vote by council. And it just doesn't look like the mayor has that. She has called a press conference for 1 o'clock today. and she's going to have members of the Jewish community with her. She's going to have Grant Moody from the Bexar County Commissioner's Court with her. But interestingly, nobody from City Council. So that doesn't suggest to me that she really has the guns to back this up. At the same time, she's not alone in terms of being a, you know, a public official that's spoken out against Ye. He faced, you know, a lot of that in Europe, especially in England and France, where, you know, there were concerts that were canceled because there was enough pushback from public officials.
This is getting national attention. New York Times, Rolling Stones, a lot of national outlets covering this.
Oh, yeah. This thing is blown up for sure.
Are people getting a read on San Antonio based on this story?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. It's hard to tell what the reaction would be in other cities because this tour only has a select number of dates. He is, you know, those remarks he made have been kryptonite, and so there aren't a whole lot of places he's been able to book. And it's not like it's, you know, a 40-city tour where we can sort of compare San Antonio to how, you know, Orlando is treating him or L.A. or New York. I mean, I guess we could compare him to L.A. because he did two nights in L.A. and performed there. But, you know, there's been outcry, all over the place where he's booked shows. The question becomes, you know, whether the public outcry, whether the outcry from certain politicians actually bears any weight. And I think this may be a case where we're seeing the mayor posturing. And, you know, who knows, maybe she does call a special session and wants to get people on the record in terms of, you know, where they stand on this. But it doesn't look like she's got the firepower to call off the concert.
Well, it does seem like this letter that we have from these six city council members condemning Kanye West and but also saying how great this is for San Antonio's economy. He's going to pump over $1 million into the local economy or some other figure. And they are values for sale, or how does that work out? What's the calculus?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, this is what I've been told from the city of San Antonio, is that the Alamo Dome staff reviews all events, whether it's Paul McCartney, whether it's Disney on Ice, whether it's Monster Jam or Ye, using the same factors, and those include public demand, expected economic impact, facility revenue, hotel bookings, and the goal of bringing you know, a wide range of entertainment events to the city. So no, I mean, I don't think the morality or immorality of the artist really enters into it. I mean, you know, for example, Chris Brown is going to be playing here in October on a tour with Usher. And Chris Brown, as you know, has been convicted of spousal abuse and any number of other, has faced criminal charges for any number of other violent offenses. You know, this is a guy who has actually done something as opposed to just saying something. Even though Kanye's comments have been very offensive and certainly deserve condemnation, you know, they're words. They're not him actually striking somebody with his hand or his fist. And then, you know, we've welcomed him back, Chris Brown, we've welcomed to the Alamo Dome for another show prior to this one. So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the city is looking at this from a dollars and cents perspective when it books people at the Alamo Dome.
Well, maybe they'll, you know, have a policy, or should they have a policy? Should they look at these things ahead of time, have some sort of process? I mean, it does.
I'm sure there was, you know, I'm sure there was discussion about whether or not this was a smart move, whether this booking would be something that could.
Well, the mayor wasn't part
problems.
Of that.
You know, I know.
It seems like she was caught off guard.
What's that?
It seemed like the mayor was caught off guard because she came out opposed to it.
She has said that she was not kept up to speed on this, was not informed about this by city staff.
Yeah. All right. Well, I got to let you go. Sanford Nowlin is the editor of the San Antonio Current. They cover a lot of concerts and live activities in San Antonio, and he certainly has his finger in the pulse of what's happening with this Kanye West concert. Sanford, thank you so much.
Yeah, nice talking to you. Bye.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about gas prices. Why are they so crazy right now? This is The Source.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. These days, it really does pay to shop for the best gas price. Prices are varying so much. I was at one street corner. It was at Babcock and Hillcrest. And there were four gas stations on each corner, one on each corner. And the prices were all over the place. As they varied as much as 60 cents a gallon. How does that happen? Is the quality of the gas the same? I don't know. I have a lot of questions. Well, this is Patrick DeHaan. He is a oil and gas price analyst with Gas Buddy, and he is here to answer your questions, my questions, about what is going on with gas prices, how is it priced, what to expect if there's going to be an oil shock. That's still a big question. And Patrick DeHaan, welcome to The Source.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Call. If you've got a question about gas prices, now's the time to call. So, Patrick, what is happening with these prices?
Well, we've seen gas prices declining over the last 6 weeks, almost on a weekly basis, depending on where one is. Texas average gas prices are down 69 cents a gallon from a month ago. The average statewide now $3.34 a gallon. Price is still up about 49 cents compared to last year, but much of the decline over the last 6 weeks or so has been as oil prices have declined, as President Trump continues to tout, or did tout at the time, a deal with Iran. Over time, now we have a deal in place to reopen the strait, and oil prices have simply been responding to either escalations and attacks that happened back in March and April, or since then, de-escalations in the talk of a deal to reopen the strait. And that is why gasoline and diesel prices have been moderating in the past, call it 5-6 weeks.
Well, we see there's a long chain of from what happens in the Strait of Hormuz before it ends up in my gas tank. And so a lot of things can happen between those two points. It's not always a straight line. And all there's hedges that these oil companies have. They've got to go through the refinery. The refineries are at max capacity right now. I'm wondering, why does it vary so much, these different gas stations? I mean, aren't they all – it's all coming from the same place, right?
No, actually not at all. Refineries can be stations, Texas having many refineries, that gasoline can come from any one of them. Across the country, there's 134 different refineries, but you're seeing a lot of discrepancies between stations because of many different things. A level of competition, some stations may be more aggressive at lowering prices. Some stations may not refill their tank every 2 to 4 days on average, but some stations may go beyond that. So what the stations are paying are going to be vastly different depending on when they bought, how much competition, where that gasoline is coming from, the cost of doing business, the cost of paying employees, and that varies station to station. So there's a lot of differences, between cities and towns. There could be different ordinances. There could be different tax levies. There could be different costs of labor, property taxes. All of those things are factors in to how gas prices determine a price. But at the end of the day, one of the biggest factors is simply competition. How much gasoline does a station want to sell? Do they want to have a higher price and sell less, or do they want to have a lower price and sell more? All of that is up to the individual station to decide.
So the individual station decides? So it's not the clerk, or it's not some guy in the corporate executive office? I mean, do they change the price throughout the day? What's happening there?
Well, it varies dramatically. It can be a mom and pop owned station. It could be a corporate owned station by somebody in a faraway city looking at the price they're paying. But ultimately, it's kind of like the stations have some decision on what they want to pay, or I should say what they want to sell for. They don't have a decision on what they want to pay for that gasoline, right? That is told to them. Much like a car dealer, right? Every car dealer might offer you a different price. Essentially, they're all paying roughly the same for that car, which is a little different than gasoline. The wholesale price of gasoline does vary on a daily level. But what a station is willing to pay or sell at, you know, makes a big difference. Some stations have different strategies. The wholesale clubs, for example, may be more aggressive in having lower prices to get you to the premises where you'll maybe go in the wholesale club and spend some of your money as well. So the agenda can vary from station to station, town to town. Ultimately, gas stations have some discretion on what to sell gasoline at, but the underlying cost of the commodity limits them. A station could, in theory, sell for 99 cents if they want to come up with the other $1.70 a gallon it may cost them, or other, you know, $2 or $3. That's up to them if they want to lose money. But ultimately, gas stations have some level of control, but ultimately the price of oil makes up a big part of what stations will sell for.
If I go to one, I think I can look, just look down the street. I can see one gas station selling for like $3.20, another one selling for $3.65. Is it basically the same gas? Does it matter?
Well, maybe slightly different, but essentially all that gasoline has to meet federal standards for the amount of detergents added. There could be marketing differences. It may be coming from different refineries. There could be different additives as well. Some stations have marketing buzzwords for what they put in premium.
But it's really not going to hurt my car.
Some stations may have a higher level of additives than another.
But it's not a big difference, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I'm going to go to the station that has a lower price. I don't really care about the additives so much as I do as the price.
So back to where all this gas is coming from. A lot of it is produced in Texas, but a lot of it we're still getting the global energy supply, the Strait of Hormuz. And we're hearing conflicting things about whether that is going to be opened up. Iran has a vote in what's going to happen, our veto, and with the Strait of Hormuz. And they're still talking about an oil shock here in the United States. We have been working down our supplies that we have, our strategic supplies. And Donald Trump recently said that we only had about 4 weeks left. The question is, could there be an oil shock coming down the road?
Well, it's hard to tell. Whether or not there's an oil shock is contingent on what happens with the Strait of Hormuz, which is contingent on however the U.S. and Iran want to handle this moving forward. You know, and obviously that's uncertain. The Trump administration has now come to a deal with Iran, but whether or not, you know, we're going to see some sort of oil shock is all unknown. Some executives, some oil company executives have been warning that that could happen, but it's impossible to know because consumers, before there is an oil shock, prices would likely skyrocket. Consumers would likely reduce their consumption. Just like we heard about this impending fuel or jet fuel shortage in Europe, it never materialized. Why? Because instead of responding at the last minute, airlines don't want to potentially go bankrupt by suddenly running out of jet fuel. So they started trimming capacity, reducing frequency, running more fuel-efficient planes. They completely changed because they are resilient. They have to respond. So whether or not there's an oil shock is really contingent on, well, do we prepare? What happens? Do prices go up? Will the strait reopen? There's a lot of questions that could prevent an oil shock from developing, and the U.S. is utilizing one of those right now in releasing oil from the strategic reserve. Now, that's a finite amount of oil, but those releases from our strategic reserves will continue really through the end of the summer before the SPR releases are over, and already those releases have reduced the strategic reserve to its lowest level since 1983. So that's problematic. But, you know, if the strait does fully reopen in the next couple of weeks, that may prevent a full-on shock from happening.
We're seeing the word, I hear the word demand destruction a lot. And that means that prices for oil is getting so high in places around the world that they have made huge adaptations and they're using less oil. And so that does impact the availability for oil and gasoline here in the United States. And so although we're paying more for gas than we were before the beginning of this war. We still have gas. We're not suffering from a crisis of supply. So, and that's, you know, that's that elastic response that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, and that would likely prevent a full-on oil shock, because as prices go up, this is a great lesson in basic economics. As prices go up, generally there will be a point where consumption will go down. And that's, you know, it's hard to know what the number is where consumption comes down, because what you may be willing to pay, I might not be willing to pay. And so nobody really knows what that magic number looks like, is when will consumers really start throttling back? While some consumers in third world countries that can't afford the prices that Americans can have already throttled back. So there has already been a level of demand destruction, but most of that demand destruction has been overseas and not so much in the U.S.
You talk to a lot of people all over the country all the time about gas prices. What are you hearing? Have people adapted to this? They adjusted, and now they're able to live with this, or are people fed up?
Well, nobody wants to live with it, right? I hear a tremendous amount of frustration with Americans who, I mean, myself included, I don't like digging deeper. Having said that, it's summer, and, you know, very few of us are going to just twiddle our thumbs at home all summer long. And that's part of why Americans complain, is because fuel is one of those purchases that may not be fun, but it enables you to go out and enjoy time with friends and loved ones this summer and, you know, be recreational, see what the country has to offer. And that's why fuel prices are so polarizing and so frustrating. And that's why generally Americans will kind of grimace and bear the price of fuel instead of cutting back.
And we have heard from President Trump that this is temporary, and when this is all over, that gas prices will be lower than ever. Does that pass your test?
Well, I mean, eventually things will end and they'll become over. Just like the pandemic, in time it resolves, and gas prices, after skyrocketing in 2022, came back down to earth. So in time, the situation will eventually normalize, but that probably won't happen overnight either. President Trump touting that, you know, making it sound like there's going to be a massive drop in gas prices and it's going to be very soon, but it probably won't be overnight. And in fact, it may take beyond weeks, it may take beyond months for global oil inventories to completely respond or completely catch back up to their pre-war levels.
So in the meantime, it pays to shop around.
Absolutely, and it always does every day of the year, and that's, you know, why the Gas Buddy app has always been around for the last 26 years, is because consumers can't really dictate what a station sells for or their price, but they can decide on where they fill their tanks up and patronize the stations that are more competitive.
Right. So I go on the site or the app, and I'm able to see, do people just report themselves, and then you sort of crowdsource the hard work there?
Yeah. So some of the data is crowdsourced. Some of it comes from gas stations that compete, or I should say gas stations that send us their prices. Some of those prices come from our payments card called Pay with Gas Buddy that can save motorists up to 33 cents a gallon. So we have a lot of different data sources. But, yes, some of it's crowdsourced. That's how we grew in popularity, is you can download the app and you can report prices to help everyone out.
And so by the election day, November 3rd, that's really where mm-hmm. The rubber meets the road on what gas prices are going to be like and what voters are going to be doing, if they're going to be voting on their gas frustrations. Do you think we're going to be about where we are right now on November 3rd?
Well, you know, over time, gas prices almost never hold still. So I think it'd be very unlikely that prices will be, you know, where they are on election day as they are today. Generally, gas prices fall in the fall, just like they go up every spring. Of course, this year we had another reason why they went up this spring. But I would generally expect that gas prices would be quite a bit lower on election day as they are today. And again, a lot of that is simply seasonal. Gas prices are higher in the spring and summer and lower in the fall and winter. So, you know, my guess, the national average by the election day might be in the low, maybe mid $3 range if things don't go well. But if things do go really well, prices could eventually end closer to falling below $3 a gallon by the end of the year.
But if we tap out the strategic reserve and we still need that extra, you know, extra oil, who knows, it could be way up there again.
Yeah, certainly could. So there's a wide range of possibilities given the continuing situation, but I'll be hopeful that prices would be closer to normal by the time the election rolls around.
Patrick DeHaan is an oil and gas price analyst and expert with Gas Buddy. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And the Source continues right after this break. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Texas Rangers have long occupied a special place in the state's mythology, celebrated as an elite force called in when local police need help solving their most difficult cases. But a troubling murder investigation in the Rio Grande Valley is raising questions about how the Rangers handle evidence, pursue suspects, and hold themselves accountable when a case goes wrong. Attorney and former Primera mayor Ernesto El Gaito Gonzalez disappeared in 2016. His remains were found 3 years later buried on land leased by his nephew Solomon Sonny Campos. Campos was charged with capital murder, but a jury acquitted him after hearing about missing evidence, lost videos, erased communications, and conflicting accounts of a possible informant and the failure to establish a clear motive. Campos now alleges that law enforcement officers framed him, while the murder of Ernesto Gonzalez remains effectively unsolved. The Texas Observer investigated. Reporter Lisa Olson examined the case, the ranger who led the investigation, and what it reveals about the agency that is stretched among homicide investigations, border operations, and other complex assignments. Lisa Olson joins us now. And Lisa, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David. It's always good to be with you. And that was a great summary of a complex problem.
Well, it's a great story. It reads like, you know, true crime. I mean, it's like a podcast on paper, you know, one of those things. So, Lisa, what first drew you to the murder of Ernesto El Gaito Gonzalez?
It's not every day that a jury votes to acquit someone in less than an hour. And then pretty much after what I heard was makes statements saying that they felt that the case was outrageous. The suspect emailed me, the Sonny Campos, and at first I thought his allegations couldn't possibly be true, but he had so many documents from his own case, and then I gathered more, and pretty much everything he alleged checked out in terms of lost evidence, improper police procedures, his targeting of him to the exclusion of other people who had obvious motives was all kind of inexplicable. And then when I dug into it, you know, this greater issue of what are the Rangers doing if they're not doing a good job helping small agencies with cold cases became front and center for me, because I found out that this Ranger in particular not only had a hand in this case that was clearly problematic, but there had been two other cases that he supposedly helped solve in the same jurisdiction in Harlingen that had also both fallen apart. In one case, there had been a plea deal in a case that should have been a slam dunk if the DNA evidence had been properly tested. And in another case, suspect was never arrested at all. And so there were a string of three screw-ups in the same city. And I thought, well, you know, this really raises, like, as you said, bigger questions about whether the Rangers are able to do what they say they can do, which is help small agencies with complex cases.
A number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you have a question or a comment about the Texas Rangers doing this type of murder investigations, or if you are familiar with this case of El Gaito and what happened to his nephew, Sonny Campos. So let's talk about how, when the Texas Rangers are called in for these type of cases, small town, you don't have a much of a police force, certainly nobody who is highly skilled in, you know, murder investigations, these detectives. You would have like in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin. And so you say, well, the Texas Rangers, they can take over the case and they have the expertise to do this. But do they really?
You know, that's a question I have, is I'm not sure how much training this particular officer or experience had in murder investigations. He certainly had some training in handling evidence. But, you know, there were issues in how the evidence was handled in the two of the three murder cases. And in one of these two cases, the one where there was a plea deal where the main suspect got off with a very, very low amount of time, basically for violating his probation, and was not charged with murder at all, the DA delivered a diatribe in court about the evidence being lost and mishandled. Very unusual, that kind of thing. And you know, as far as I could tell, what we're seeing now is that the Rangers are stretched so thin between assignments to the border and mandate from the legislature to try to review deaths in jails that they really don't spend a lot of time investigating murders, even in the border region where there are quite a lot of murders. Very few do more than one case in their career. There's only a handful that do two or more. And the Rangers, furthermore, have had this huge wave of retirements, which I think raises questions, too, about whether the Rangers who do have experience are even there to mentor other people like this Ranger, who told me, you know, he said there's pretty, I think, striking quotes in the article about how he wishes that Rangers had less to do, that he doesn't think it's a good system, the way the whole thing's organized. Now, he defended his own work, but he certainly said he didn't think that Rangers had enough time to do these kinds of cases.
For me, when I'm covering stories, things that happen out in rural areas, and then you hear, okay, we're handing the case over to the Texas Rangers to investigate, and then we're going to hand over the prosecution to the AG's office. And then we hear nothing. We don't get any information until there is some sort of kind of plea deal or there's a concrete movement in the case. But we don't get any kind of information at all other than we can't talk about cases that are under investigation. Meanwhile, people need information about a horrific thing that happened in their community. It does seem sometimes, from my experience, that this handing things off to the Texas Rangers is a way to put a lid on things and so that no one can talk about something that is maybe embarrassing to the local community.
I think you're right. I think there's some buck passing here. Harlingen police certainly had already a huge, you know, problem in that the DA in this previous homicide case before they started investigating this one had said in court that this police department messed up another murder case, lost all the evidence. The DA didn't in court mention the Ranger, which is kind of odd, but you know that department was really in a bad spot and had already been called out as bad in the publicly by the DA. And so when they go back to this Ranger for more help, initially he says, no, I don't want to help you, which is also kind of shocking. So again, you wonder if there really is a need to address difficult cases and cold cases, which I would argue there is statewide, why doesn't the state police create some sort of homicide detective force of people who are specifically specialists in homicide? As we know, there's a lot of great homicide detectives who retire at fairly young ages from cities like San Antonio and Houston who wouldn't mind continuing to work on homicide cases later, or cold cases. But instead, the Rangers are sort of handling this as one of their many details. This guy had a past that included, you know, working with canines, working on drug cases, working with drones, you know. There wasn't any previous homicide experience, really, until he got handed these three cases in Harlingen. And he had to learn on the job.
But the Texas Rangers, they do have a cold case program. As a matter of fact, just this week, they announced that they were expanding this cold case program so that they would be able to. It's a specialized unit dedicated to solving cold case murders and sexual assaults across the state. So isn't that what you're talking about?
Well, they have that program. They have in that program, they brag about this case as one that was solved by the Texas Rangers. The Ernesto Gonzalez El Gallito murder case was solved by the Texas Rangers cold case unit. As far as I can tell, you know, this ranger wasn't really part of that specialized group. I don't know actually at this point how many specialized officers they have who really have substantial homicide experience. The database I got from the Rangers, which I saw, I analyzed for the story, showed there's only a handful of Rangers who've done more than a couple of murder cases. And yet all around the state, what usually happens is the local ranger gets assigned to a cold case. It isn't necessarily some elite ranger. It's the local guy. And that's what happened in this case.
And how can you say the case was solved when the suspect was acquitted? And not just acquitted, but acquitted with, it seemed like, you know, with some expeditious, you know, results saying this should never have gone to trial.
You know, certainly some of the jurors said things like that. The defense attorney said something like that. There is a civil lawsuit pending in federal court that alleges that it's pretty unusual for a murder suspect to sue public officials in Texas. So far, the case has not been dismissed. There is a lot of, you know, immunity that public officials and police enjoy in this kind of a case, but it'll be interesting to see if they're held accountable at all for the amount of lost evidence, faulty procedure, and errors that were made here.
We're going to get into those details when we come back from the break. You can call in if you've got a question or comment about this case. It was high profile down in the Rio Grande Valley about El Gallito and Gonzalez, and about the trial of his nephew, Solomon Sonny Campos. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source will continue after this one-minute break. Stay with us.
The largest sports tournament in the world is about to arrive in Texas, the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Teams from across the globe are set to play at Dallas Stadium and Houston Stadium in June.
Whether you're a diehard fan or just a little soccer curious, we've got you covered.
When the World Comes to Texas is a new podcast from KERA News.
We'll talk to the people holding down the sport and the culture here in Texas.
It's out now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me is investigative reporter Lisa Olson at the Texas Observer. She is just an outstanding investigative reporter, and she has turned her lens to the Texas Rangers and how they handled a high-profile murder case in the Rio Grande Valley, the murder of Ernesto El Gallito Gonzalez. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Lisa has found that there were a lot of mishandling of the evidence. There was the arrest and the indictment and the trial of the suspect, Solomon Sonny Campos, and questions about whether that should have actually happened. Were they more interested in clearing the case or actually finding justice, trying to find the real killer? Let's go to Henrietta on the phones. And Henrietta, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I love what Lisa is doing. In fact, I would like some more information and ask her. Maybe you have my number. I would like to talk to her because there are a lot of agencies that can give support, but they don't know how to reach out for them, or if they reach out to them, they can get demoralized, the new officers, because there's a lot of people that want to do good in the police, but there's some that just, because I've been a resident of this town in a long time, and like hate crimes, and also the parks, the Rangers, Texas Rangers, they don't also investigate hate crimes because I have people call them and they never return calls. And that is so sad because they have all the power and all the help and they just don't do. And I wish these young guys would reach the FBI or their other agencies that have the expertise that should allow them to help them. And we could have a better police force.
All right, Henrietta, thank you for the call. So, I mean, you're talking about Texas Ranger Raul Roy Garza, but you're looking at the system, Lisa, that he was put in a system where he was kind of set up to fail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he would argue that, and he does argue in the story, I talked to him for a long time, he just retired. He is now a fishing guide. He said, you know, when I was a ranger, we just had way too many things to do. We shouldn't have to patrol the border, do drones, investigate all in custody deaths, and also help local agencies with cases like this. That's too much for any one officer to do. And, you know, if you look at the number of rangers, like I said, that have retired in the last couple of years since Uvalde, since the shootings, there have been a massive wave of retirements. There just aren't as many as there were that have any experience. So, and a lot of the rangers come up as, you know, patrolmen. They start as DPS officers. So if you want to actually get a ranger through the training they need to become a good homicide investigator, they need to go to a lot of trainings and not just be deployed to the border. And the system we have now isn't really enabling that to a great extent.
Let's go to another caller. We have Javier. Javier, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Hey, Lisa, I got to take an issue with you about them. Perhaps they're too thinly stretched, the ranges, Texas Rangers. How thinly stretched were they at the Uvalde massacre when they massacred all them little kids? You know, they're a bunch of bandits. They gave them a badge. They're like the modern-day version of the ICE department, you know?
Sure.
So it's like, please. NPR had a lady on that remembers when she used to go to that elementary school back in the 70s that were pushing for more Chicano teachers and studies. They called the Rangers, and the lady, she's an older lady now, says, yeah, I remember they were on the roof of our school pointing their guns at us, the Texas Rangers. Hmm. One ranger, one riot. What a bunch of BS.
All
okay,
right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. So, Lisa, there's a lot of history there, particularly in South Texas.
Right.
And so that we have this legend of they have to live up to. Of course, it's impossible to be able to meet those incredible legendary standards. But also at the same time, we're dealing with the history of supporting racist policies in the state of Texas.
Absolutely. And I would argue that that's another reason why, you know, it makes sense for the DPS to have a totally separate unit that is a homicide unit, homicide missing persons unit. Those kinds of units do exist in other state police organizations. Increasingly, very advanced DNA tests are needed to try to help solve a lot of these cases. You know, it would make a lot of sense. I don't see Texas moving in that direction. We've kept the Rangers despite the arguments about their history and the facts about their history. And the fact that in Uvalde, most recently, they stood there while children were killed. And that's part of, I think, the subtext of the story is this story happens after that. The Rangers have been disgraced. The lead Rangers have, a couple of them have, either retired or resigned. There's a wave of retirements. You can argue on one hand that left them shorthanded, and the Ranger Garza argues that left him unequipped to handle it, you know, not with the time to handle a case like this. You could also argue that maybe it's a good time to look at whether there should be some other unit put together for cold cases and for homicides that's specifically composed of people who are specialists in homicide cases. There are people like that in Texas. We wouldn't have to stick with this system.
So regardless of what the Texas Rangers said, this case is not solved. We still don't know who killed Ernesto El Gallito Gonzalez. And you paint a portrait of him. He was an attorney. He was the mayor of a small town in the Rio Grande Valley. He had a lot of enemies, including many of his own family. So there were a lot of suspects out there, people who had threatened his life. He had gotten protective orders against them, and he had filed testimony against them, but not the person that they arrested, his nephew, Sonny Campos. So how did they get from making Sonny Campos the suspect and then putting him in jail? Just because someone had buried El Gallito's body on his rented land?
Right. This is what's a really interesting part of this mystery is, like you said, David, Ernesto Gonzalez had a ton of enemies. He was a tough character. He would challenge people. He would say what he thought. He had been an informant in a federal corruption case. He had handled all sorts of messy divorces. He had this big feud with his family members, and he had protective order against some of them where he said they had threatened his life. He carried a gun to defend his own life. He had gotten emails from anonymous people threatening him because of his defense, criminal defense practice. He had been beaten up after a camping trip on the beach in Texas by a group of people who seemingly didn't like the fact that he picked a certain woman that was someone else's girlfriend. So there were just no shortage of people who could have killed him that had motives. Sonny had no motive. Sonny is an unusual character. He is a guy who doesn't drink. He and his wife go to church every Sunday. You know, he's always been a police officer of some sort or a guard his whole life. He passed
multiple background checks. He was a clean sheet.
Yes, he had to pass regular background checks for his job, which was being a contractor for the Border Patrol. So he was just an unusual suspect.
But you know, being arrested and put on trial, that ruins your life. It is not something that is not punitive. It is punitive.
It absolutely is. Being arrested, and he had a huge bond put on him that it took a long time for his wife to raise the money to pay. She had to sell her house, the house she had bought as a teacher before they married. And he could never get back the job that he had had, where he'd had 20-some years of service. So, yes, it effectively ruined his life. He thinks, you know, he was just somebody who it was easy to blame him. He says, you know, the property I owned that I rented, he didn't even own it, was no one lived on the property. And so it was easy for somebody to put a body there to make it look like I did it. And what was really amazing about that is that there had been multiple searches of that land before the body was finally found in 2020, even though the ranger says, oh, it was very obvious in 2020 where the body was. That statement doesn't really make much sense if in prior searches no one could find it, including with cadaver dogs. It makes it look more like, well, if the property area looked recently disturbed in 2020, maybe it was.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm almost out of time. So
yeah.
Campos is now pursuing a federal civil rights lawsuit, but the police officers, they have qualified immunity protection. So is there anything that can actually come from this civil rights lawsuit?
You're right. They have qualified immunity. He would have to prove it'd have to be a very high bar for him to prove the negligence and for him to prevail.
Incompetence. I don't think incompetence, you know, if that's,
no,
that would work.
No, that's,
yeah,
you're absolutely right. It's, I think he's, you know, it's a very, very long shot case. However, you know, there have very occasionally been rulings against public officials in relation to wrongful arrest. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I don't give him a lot of high odds to win. But I think he's trying to make a point beyond that, that this was an unjust arrest, that Texans deserve better, that he deserved better, and this should not stand And he's sending that message in part through this court case.
Right, and real murderers should be brought to justice. Texas Observer reporter Lisa Olson examines the case of Gallito's murder. You can find the Texas Observer at the bookstore. Take a look in the magazine section. You can go online and read the article as well. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.